This week on the Woven Energy Podcast.
Shamanism and animism are absolutely not belief systems. In many ways, they are the opposite of belief systems. But when you're writing history, you see the world through the lens of your present, through your miasma, if you like. At one time in Switzerland, you were hard-pressed to actually find a woman because virtually all of them had been burned or executed as witches. Go and read those books. But if nature tells you something and those books tell you something else, then those books are worthless in that subject area. That's my teaching. Now, there's a very, very different attitude to if I was a teacher of, say, Christianity. I'd like to have a section alongside that called smart action.
Smart doing.
Smart doing, yeah. And what that gives rise to is a lack of a very, very important quality, which is one of the reasons why hunter-gatherer societies have got in abundance. The initial part of this series of podcasts is to outline the stages in becoming a shaman.
Yeah.
Inevitably, the practical exercises are going to come in waves as we cover each of those stages.
Perfect.
You can give yourself experiences in which it's not culture, but nature that is influencing you. That is a definition of shamanic technique.
Welcome to the Woven Energy Podcast on Shamanism. I'm Joe, and I'm here once again to talk with Damon Smith about shamanism from the ground up. So this is our last episode, for now at least, on the miasma, which is a concept recognized in more animistic societies, but perhaps not our own as much. Damon said something last episode which is worth repeating here. He said, the miasma is a falseness which sits between us and reality. It's like a filter constructed from society, culture, materialism, our judgments, our opinions, our faiths, our beliefs, and everything we think we know passes through this miasmatic filter. And so it's so important to recognize this or its effects on us if we are to perform effective shamanic technique. And by that, I mean derive knowledge from nature raw and not through our lenses shaped by the miasma. It's so important. So Damon, is there anything you want to add to that description of the miasma before we continue this episode on?
Well, kind of interesting. Since the last one that we did, which wasn't too long ago, I keep thinking of more and more things that are really important to say about the miasma. And I've certainly got a list longer than this episode. So all I would say is that it's not something that we're going to forget about. We'll come back to it again, 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 much later when we move on from the subject of shamanism and we move on to the more difficult subject of esotericism. I mean, difficult in terms of shamanism is a difficult subject, but it is able to achieve its goals through a fairly obvious process. Yeah. That is a known quantity. Esotericism, even today, despite thousands of years of development, which is the further development of shamanism within settled civilized societies, that is not a known quantity, even after all of that work. There's a lot more complexity there. And for instance, in terms of specific exercises to combat the miasma, shamanism itself has very few. They are the Chalicity exercises. We've already been over some of them. We'll go over some more in the future. But in terms of combating your own miasma, the exercises we gave in the three podcasts on Chalicity are exactly the exercises that shamanism would use to combat the miasma, are very, very similar exercises.
Well, you said something interesting to me, because we were discussing this, because I'm always trying to make sure we're getting some practical stuff across. But you were saying that exercises themselves, they wouldn't have been
correct,
needed back when shamanism was in our lives, because
they wouldn't be needed to anything like the same extent that we need them. The techniques that shamans use to combat their own, going back in time, I almost said historically, but a lot of this, of course, is prehistory. They needed to combat their own very lightweight miasma are exactly the same techniques that shamanism would use today to combat our heavyweight miasma. Just, I think, as we've said in the podcast on Chalicity, we need to focus on that stuff more than members of animistic populations. Shamanism builds in layers. It's a foundation, but each successive layer, starting with Chalicity, extends into the layers above it. And extends all the way through to the top, you know, all the way through to the final layer or stage of component of shamanism, or the process of becoming a shaman, the Nechtel. There's still Chalicity there. Chalicity has extended up all the way from the base, all the way up through the layers, all the way up into that layer. So
we've barely scratched the surface on Chalicity, and we've barely scratched the surface on the miasma.
Yeah, but the point I'm trying to make is. One of the reasons why I've been banging away about Chalicity from episode one is we members of settled civilized societies need Chalicity even more than animists do, members of animist societies. And yet we are far worse at it than them. So in terms of how do I combat my own miasma? How do I start to combat my own miasma? At the individual level, at the personal level, from the point of view of making your shamanism effective, the answer to that is ceaselessly practice and improve your Chalicity. At a later date, we will talk about some of the additional techniques that developed within esotericism that are not part of, if you like, the original shamanism that developed specifically because esotericism is shamanism. Knowingly practiced within a miasmatic society. Esotericism did develop further techniques, but these techniques are applied at a different level, at a very different level. And I'd rather get shamanism out of the way before we start addressing esoteric techniques.
Great stuff. Well, if you're joining us at these episodes, I want to point out that the episodes on Chalicity are episodes 7, 8, and 9. We did a 3-part miniseries on it, each looking at the 3 components of Chalicity, which build and build and build.
One other thing I would add is that, you know, very soon we're going to be getting onto the subject of Amskar. But when we get onto that, you'll be the sick of the sight of exercises by the time we get onto Amskar.
That's good to know. I think it is so important that we do keep these episodes as practical as possible because, you know, we are talking about a practical subject here, which is heavily steeped in experience.
In the nature of what we're doing, though, remember, we're the initial part of this series of podcasts is to outline the stages in becoming a shaman.
Yeah.
Inevitably, the practical exercises are going to come in waves as we cover each of those stages.
Perfect. Which gives people a chance, I think, to practice them as well.
Sure.
Because I remember even you were saying when you first started out, to feel like you got somewhere with Chalicity took you 6 months. And you were saying that as if that was a short amount of time.
Yeah, and I was working hard on it. Yeah. I was working hard on it.
It's a discipline. It's hard work. So do you want to carry on then? You said you've got a lot of notes in front of you.
The way I was going with that was that we're never going to get all this covered in this episode. So,
okay, well,
so
we're going to be exploring this in the future. I'm sure.
Let's see what we can get done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things, you know, we were talking about the traits of the miasma. The examples that I didn't mention, I don't know if it's a trait or whether it's an example, but for instance, in our society, there's an idea that, problems, psychological problems, problems of trauma, are resolved by talking about them. An unspoken assumption that by talking things through, things get better. Now, this may be true in some cases. You know, this, again, obviously, this talking things through and rationalizing things and bringing them to the fore when they're suppressed. Obviously, that's baseline activity. And sometimes for some kinds of problems, that is useful. Unfortunately, I believe, and I think there's some evidence to back this idea up, that is in some cases those problems, emotional problems, problems of trauma, that type of thing, are actually worsened or reinforced by talking them through. Because thinking about them is not an outlet. Thinking about a problem is not addressing it. If it's not a problem of the baseline. And problems that are associated with emotion about how you feel, they tend not to be of the baseline. And there was a time, I think, fortunately, people in I don't know what to call it, legal circles, I always call it the legal industry, have recently realized that the limbic system, the part of the brain that's deal with, if you like, it's an important part of the brain in terms of the top line. The limbic system is intimately connected with long-term memory. Indeed, the part of the brain that deals or manages long-term memory is part of the limbic system. And that's both a benefit and a problem. If you understand the world in a top-line way, you can use that as a great example, as a great advantage. And that's what shamanistic technique seeks to do. You can use it as a positive advantage in your life. If you try to address the limbic system as if it's a baseline system, you may end up, on the one hand, reinforcing problems that are already there, i.e. making people feel worse about something rather than better. Or in some cases, it may be in the short term, it makes them feel better. But then in the longer term, it prevents them from moving on. It prevents them from dealing with real traumas and real problems. But then there's an addition, as I said, in the legal profession, there was a time period not very long ago, we're talking a few years, when the idea of recovered memories was taken as strong evidence. Recovered memories were taken as strong evidence in courts of law. Yeah. And there were a very large number of miscarriages of justice on the basis of this. The current science indicates that those, and again, that came out of the tradition of Freud. If the investigator is looking for something, they will find it unless they're very, very careful in terms of what the way in which they're expressing themselves. So this idea of psychologists asking leading questions, which, especially under techniques like hypnosis, again, we have to talk about hypnosis in another episode, and supposedly recovering suppressed memories from within an individual, that fits very, very nicely with Freud's view of the world. But unfortunately, it doesn't fit nicely at all with current scientific understanding of how the brain works. And I'm not saying there are no such thing as recovered memories and there are no such thing as suppressed memories, but that stuff is treated in very recent times, in very recent years, because of the many miscarriages of justice that fell out of it. That stuff is treated with extreme care in courts of law in first world countries now, whereas just a few years ago, it was taken very seriously indeed. Mm. And there are a lot of cases, for instance, where recovered memories were used to convict somebody and then DNA evidence acquits them after they've been convicted on the basis of recovered memories. The DNA evidence obviously being hard, solid fact. The recovered memories were treated as if they were hard, solid fact, when in fact they are at best circumstantial evidence. Mm. And I'm not saying, again, we're back to this subject of sincerity. I'm not saying that the people given evidence in those trials involving recovered memories, I'm not saying that they were insincere. What I'm saying is the people who recovered or helped them, in inverted commas, to recover those memories, in many cases, not all, were creating those memories.
It's interesting you say that, because I've been doing a little bit of reading on this. It's a subject which kind of fascinates me. And I was reading that every single memory is a reframe. So every time we remember something, our mind sort of reframes it depending on the kind of mood that we're in and how we're feeling at the time.
Exactly.
Which means, like, it can open ourselves up to all sorts of our memories being reprogrammed. So when we actually remember something from a long time ago, maybe it's not perhaps as accurate as it as it once was.
Well, you know what's very interesting, as you know, I've written a history book. Fortunately, I didn't write it under my own name, so nobody will know which one it was, because and it's not particularly a book that I'm proud of. It's okay, you know. If I wrote it many years ago when I was still young.
Yeah.
And
well, you might as well tell us the name of it.
People no.
Interested. No? Oh, okay, then.
okay, go on then. It's called The Mongol Invasions of Japan, and I apologize if anybody does read it. it's a history book about the two failed attempts of the Mongol Empire to invade Japan and why those attempts failed. Yeah, so that it's my pseudonym, Mark Winchester. Who, incidentally, when we were talking about, you know, go out and be somebody else, Mark Winchester is one of my creations. When you're writing history, you see the world through the lens of your present, through your miasma, if you like. So if you imagine, you know, you talked about wearing colored glasses, you know, like green or blue or whatever, tinted glasses as you're seeing history. But I think what gets missed by a lot of historians, you know, I wouldn't claim to be a historian, I've written a history book, is that you then see what you don't necessarily pick up on is the miasma of the previous generation and the one before that and the one before that and the one before that. And if we're going back to the Mongol invasions of Japan, for instance, the 13th century, there's an awful lot of generations of effectively reinterpretation of history gone on between then and now. And if you really, really want to see what goes on there, you know, then you need to take what went on then. You really need to take all of those into account, you know. I guess modern historians wouldn't take for instance, the back end of the Tokugawa era, you know, coming up to from 1800 through to 1868, they probably wouldn't take that into account when addressing the history of the Mongol invasions of Japan. But if they don't do so, then they end up with the miasma of the Tokugawa era in their historical writings. Mm. And I think there's an awful, in that particular book, I don't recommend it. Like I say, I was very young. There's an awful lot of miasma, and I, when I've read that book back, I cringe basically these days. But you know, it's all water under the bridge.
I think it's something which a lot of people might not think about, because popular books like Lao Tzu's books or Chuang Tzu's, you know, or famous other esoteric texts, you've got to remember the miasma of the time, haven't you?
Sure. But not of the time, not just, what I'm saying is, not just of the time, of the time after that, and 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 your time. Yeah. And in China in particular, I mean, Chinese culture is wonderful in that it has effectively, Chinese culture up until very recent times, and even in these recent times, it has preserved the culture of the, what we would call the ancient world, down into the present. Therefore, for a historian, China is just about the best subject you can pick, because for any individual country on the planet, no country on the planet has more history than China. But obviously, Chinese history has been seen through so many different generations of miasmatic lenses that it has a bigger problem with that stuff than the history of any other country. History China, amazing, overwhelmingly large subject.
Okay, let's just reverse back up a little bit, because I do have a question which relates to what you've just been talking about. Broad brushstrokes, because I know you're not a doctor or anything like that. So, but do you have any thoughts on the miasma and depression, or like or mental illness in general?
Okay, well, let's stay off those words, but I'm going to answer the question in an affirmative way. I do have an idea. Within ourselves, you know, the idea we talked about talking things through helps you deal with them. Yeah. And that, you know, it may be true sometimes, but it ain't necessarily so. And those times when it's not necessarily so, that's the miasma. Well, also, a lot of people, myself included, are brought up thinking, as we've said many times, this is the baseline bias, that thinking problems through solves them. And many years ago, I used to teach self-defense. Many, many years ago. God, I'm sat here feeling old, you know. I used to teach, I'm not saying where, but I used to teach self-defense in a city center, a particular city. There were a lot of people in that city were concerned because there was a reasonable amount of, in certain parts of the city, particularly the part where I was teaching, there was a lot of mugging going on at the time, street robbery. Mm. And I wasn't the only person teaching self-defense in that particular center. There was somebody teaching self-defense in terms of assertiveness, or a sort of psychology-based self-defense type of way of viewing the subject. And I'm not saying there's no value in that approach, but one of the discussions I had with this particular teacher was that part of that teacher's worldview was that if you don't look concerned, if you look relaxed and competent and on top of things, and you don't look afraid, then people are less likely to pick on you. That was kind of the basis of their approach.
Yeah.
And my view on that is, so that's a baseline kind of answer, isn't it? I'll pretend to be unconcerned, and yeah, then they won't attack me.
Yeah.
My view on that at the time was, and probably still is to a certain extent, is that if you want to be unconcerned or less concerned or less afraid in that situation, if somebody attacks you and you're able to physically do something about that, because an attack is a midline problem, it's not a baseline problem, then you're likely to actually be less concerned and less afraid. And, you know, in terms of any effectiveness that might have in terms of deterring people from attacking you, I would say that you're going to be far more authentically unafraid if you're physically capable to do something if they attack you than if you're not. So this is the difference. You know, there's an example of obsession with the baseline answers to problems. But in terms of psychological problems, difficulties, people with a lot of time on their hands, very often they'll sit around trying to think through their problems in order to solve them. I've got to think in a different way. You go in the bookshop, there's this smart thinking section, you know, there's a section that reinforces the baseline bias if ever there was one, you know. I'd like to have a section alongside that called smart action.
Smart doing.
But I feel that I'm not, you know, I feel that some of those people, perhaps a large number of those people, are actually reinforcing the problem by going over and over and over. They've got midline and top line problems, but they're going over and over and over them on their head in the baseline. And the baseline isn't coming up with a satisfactory solution. They keep trying different ones. They isn't coming up with a satisfactory solution. And they feel worse and worse and worse and worse. And if they've got a lot of time on their hands, they can send themselves, in my opinion, just simply through that process, certainly into anxiety, into a constant anxiety, which is not good for you. Because that kind of thing, you know, we talked about not being able to pay your mortgage, that kind of thing. Stress response shuts down parts of your body that aren't needed when a tiger or lion is attacking you. Yeah. You don't want to be concentrating on digesting food. When a lion jumps out of the long grass and comes to eat you, your body, your autonomic nervous system controls all that, and it will shut down your digestion so that you can use all of your energy for sticking the spear in the lion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, And that's designed as a short-term thing. Naturally, it's a useful, natural response. It's designed as a short-term thing. The problem with our invented problems on the baseline mortgages and trying to resolve our psychological, our mental health, if you like, issues on the baseline, which caused those issues in the first place in many cases, is is, frankly, in many cases, it's madness. Because if you do that over long periods of time, the baseline doesn't solve the problem, and you end up with, for instance, you can't never pay off your mortgage, and you know you have this long running months and months and months of being in risk of losing your home, or you have things that you're unhappy about, upset about, or afraid of, and you keep trying to think them through and they don't go away. That's long term stress response, and that is not natural. And unfortunately, one of the things that's among many other things that tends to suppress your autonomic nervous system will suppress your immune system if you do that. And that is not good. Yeah. Because obviously, briefly, your immune system, you got all these antibodies and all these white blood cells ready to combat any disease coming into you. There's no problem while you're fighting, you know, in the sort of 30 seconds to 5 minutes that you're fighting off a lion with your spear. There's no problem shutting your immune system down. You know, because there's plenty of stuff there, but you shut it down for months on end. That is not helpful. You know, that's really, really not helpful. So yeah, I think that one of the comments that I've heard, obviously there are chemical things involved in this as well. So don't think I'm saying it's all psychological. Mm. It's certainly not. But even when there's chemical things, you know, people who are famously depressed, Winston Churchill, for instance, and that's a chemical thing. It's not anything that's their fault. It's just a genetic chemical problem. Mm. When they're very, very busy, like, you know, you're running the country during World War II, it's much less of a problem than if you sat around all day worrying about things. Yeah. Mm. And thankfully, you know, there are a lot of, views on Churchill's ability as an actual prime minister, you know, peacetime prime minister. I'm not talking about that, but thank goodness he was a hard worker, you know, during those war years, you know. Mm-hmm. So yes, I believe that there are some cases. I won't say the proportion, but I will think there are some cases where there is somebody who doesn't really have any psychological mental health problems. They end up, for whatever reason, with a lot of time on their hands, and they end up with psychological and mental health problems through baseline obsession, so effectively through the miasma.
Fantastic. Okay.
So again, what I'm saying is if you one of the techniques you can use if you feel you have issues like that is get busy.
Yeah. Start doing stuff. Action.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is physical things. Yeah.
Which is in sync with a lot of the thinking around now anyway. That's the advice that's given out, which is good. Okay, do you want to carry on with some examples then? Because you were talking, last episode, you were talking about the Salem witch trials, which was a big one.
Yeah, in a way, the Salem witch trials they're very famous. I think unfairly so. You know, because they actually happened within the British Empire, because at that time, Massachusetts this is before it had become part of the USA, you know. So, although the Salem witch trials are associated with the US, I think they're probably the most famous witch trials in the world. Actually, in terms of the amount of damage done, it was a drop in the ocean compared to the amount of damage we did through our witch hunts in Europe, in the 16th and 17th centuries. You know, in what is now the US, you're talking about a few tens of people, and in Europe, you're talking about a few tens of thousands, possibly even more than that. You know, actually, it could be into the millions, depending on how you view it. Give you an example of that. At one time in Switzerland, you were hard pressed to actually find a woman, because virtually all of them had been burned or executed as witches, virtually the whole female population of Switzerland, during the height of the European witch hunts. Yeah. So, obviously, unfortunately, in terms of that miasma, the dangerous end of the Christian miasma, you could call it, because of the way that Christianity views the world, you could say that because of the way the Abrahamic religions of the Abrahamic tradition view the world, again, as a shamanist, I don't know why they don't get on, really. You know, you've got Christianity, Islam, Judaism, I don't understand why they don't get on with each other. And even within Christianity, you've got the Anglicans and you've got the Roman Catholic Church and you've got the Orthodox. Why they don't get on, I don't know. Because from a shamanist point of view, those things are practically the same religion. There's so little difference, you can hardly slip a wafer between them in terms of their worldview and their attitudes to the world, their cultural worldview. They're virtually the same as each other. That's from a shamanist point of view, an animist point of view. I'm sure that if you're a hardcore member of one of those religions, you don't see that and you see huge differences between them. But from an outsider looking in at that group of related, very closely related traditions, practically the same thing. Mm. There's a rather uncontroversial opinion. But within those traditions, obviously the Adam and Eve story is what kicks it all off. Eve was a bigger culprit than Adam, as far as they're concerned. And therefore, in those days, you know, during the European witch hunts, 16th, 17th centuries, if you're a woman, you're in a lot more danger than if you're a man, simply because of that. Again, back to that miasmatic example of the original sin, you know?
Yeah.
So what's happening there? What is happening there? Well, again, it's about social control, but I think in those particular cases, certainly the case of Switzerland, that was social control probably run amok even more than the people who initiated that anticipated. You know, something slightly sex snowballed, yeah? Yeah. I'm pretty sure they didn't set out to wipe out their female population, you know? But what's happened, you know, talking about the traits of the miasma that there, I, as a Christian, or I, as the Christian miasma, have invented this concept of a witch, something that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And then that witch, has a relationship with Satan, again, something which doesn't exist, that I've invented a fiction. And that relationship is the basis of a conviction, a legal conviction and an execution, a pretty unpleasant execution, it has to be said as well. Two fictions, on the basis of two fictions. One is that witches even exist in the first place. They don't. And, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, the Gardnerian witches, the modern Gardnerian witches, who are generally awesome. I love those people. I'm talking about back then, there were no such thing as witches. Yeah. And another fiction, this idea of Satan, you know, we invent something and then use it as social leverage. Put two fictions together and we can kill somebody. Legally speaking. When your ideas, when your belief, your faith in that things exist that don't, becomes very, very powerful, it seeps into society. It may or may not have been cynically created. We don't know, usually in most cases. But the Puritan social elite in Massachusetts, at the time of the Salem witch trials, they had a miasma that had been handed down to them. Their miasma was already there. Some of those people could, if they wanted to use, for instance, it kind of started off, I suspect, with some of the social elites. Obviously, there's a social elites within Puritan society as well. The closing years of the 17th century. There are people around me. I'm a social elite and there are people around me. I'm a bit snobbish, you know, probably snobbish is the best word, or if you can use that to describe Puritans, because I feel that that is snobbishness, even though it seems self-sacrificing. It's an elitism. Mm. There are people around me who don't support my religious views. Why don't they support my religious views? Well, probably because they're in league with the Satan. I don't think Satan's a fiction. I think he's real. And there are even people who, horror of horrors, don't attend church. Can you believe that? You know, And then there are other people who are, you know, a bit troublesome, you know, a troublesome servant. Oh, my goodness, you know. Beggars, you know, or maybe just people who don't look nice, you know, some old ladies who live, they're a bit dirty, they live in a cabin somewhere. And I don't really like seeing these people, you know. It reminds me that I'm not perhaps as charitable as I claim to be. And then again, you know, there are people who just don't do what I want them to do, whatever that is. You know, maybe that's just believing in Satan a bit more as strongly as I do. And I was somebody like this. What can I use in order to resolve this problem? Ah, I can use the miasma. And I can actually use the miasma to get rid of them. So what I do is, because I want to do this all above board, I start looking around. I start looking around for evidence that they're in league with the fiction Satan. And just very fortunately, there are some kids in the village who are having hysterics. Who'd have thought? Yeah, kids having hysterics, you know. Never seen that before, you know. And especially in a highly repressive society that doesn't allow them to be children, that frowns upon things like play, yeah. Play being evidence that you're in league with Satan, obviously, you know, excessive interest in playing, and it treats them like they're little age adults, not at the age of 18, but the age of 6. And these children have all that need for Tortial Teen building up inside of them. And then it's all socially suppressed. And then, hey, presto, they go into hysteria, you know. Yeah. And then that's clearly evidence that some of the undesirable people in the village are witches. Yeah, they're in league with Satan.
You cast a spell on them.
Yeah, yeah. And so it snowballed. And basically they ended up killing one person after another. Which was fine, you know, as far as most people were concerned, it was fine as long as it was the you know, the riffraff, the low-ranking riffraff who didn't really matter.
The undesirables.
The undesirables, yeah. But the problem is that the accusation, and actually they used the children in some of the trials, you know. The prosecution, as soon as they started talking about, talk about leading people to recovered memories. As soon as they started talking at an appropriate point that was going to be negative to the defendant, perfectly on cue, beautifully timed, the kids would go into hysterics. They'd go into hysterics, just as, you know, the person who was the supposed witch was being talked about, you know. And that was taken as evidence that the witch was indeed, you know, but, you know, think about it. You know, if there had been a real Satan, and you would hope he had a bit more nouns than that, you know, he would be stopping them going into hysterics at exactly that point, you know, you would have thought, you know, if he was truly evil, you know. And this was all taken as proof, and people were murdered. There's no other word for it than that. People were murdered by Puritan society. There's no other way to say it than that. You know, very often with religion, people pussyfoot around and because they're frightened of giving offense, but, you know, Puritan society, the huge miasma within that society murdered those people. All of them, every single one of them was innocent. It did come to an end briefly. It came to an end because increasingly high-ranking members of society started getting accused, and then a whole bunch of fairly senior people came in and you know, in a fairly quiet way, had to put a stop to it. Yeah, and it sort of all blew over. But they didn't learn their lesson. You know, to a certain extent, they didn't learn their lesson. There was a woman called Lucretia Brown who was tried for witchcraft in the same state a long time later. We're talking about like 1878. And basically you can see aspects of the miasma here, the miasma being used to create stuff in leading questioning of vulnerable people, because that's what the children were. They were vulnerable people. They weren't guilty of this. This was the adults effectively using their miasma to give young people, effectively children, remember my definition of children, anyone below the age of 25, to give young people psychological problems to cause them to go into hysteria. and then to use that fact to blame completely innocent people, and then to torture those people, because before they were murdered, they were tortured. And some of these people were servants verging on slaves. And, you know, so abuse of vulnerable people, abuse of young children, abuse of slaves. Also, any kind of association with nature, the natural world, animal spirits, anything that was taken as absolute evidence of guilt. So obviously, if you're a poor person, you've got to make ends meet. You have no choice. You've got to go and chop firewood. You've got to go and, you know, you can't go down to the shop and buy a nicely shrink-wrapped chicken. You've got to go and get a chicken yourself, you know. And so that's evidence of guilt. Just marks on your body, evidence of guilt. Evil, ironically, was being sought. It was being sought out by the miasmatic Puritan culture. They were seeking out evil, not realizing, of course, that the thing that was driving their seeking was that very evil. And, you know, as I've said, Satan is a fiction, but in the story of the Salem witch trials, I see Satan in the, if you want to call their version of Satan, even the Christian version of Satan, even if you believe in it, I'd say Satan was on the side of the accusers rather than the accusees, if you want to look at it in a metaphorical way. What happens in those societies is because the obsession with the baseline gets so ridiculously strong that it becomes strict or stifling like a straitjacket. And what that gives rise to is a lack of a very, very important quality, which is one of the reasons why hunter-gatherer societies have got in abundance, and which is why they are happy all the time, despite nature being red in tooth and claw, and that is it gives rise to lack of compassion. And when the quality of your relationships with other people becomes less important than the nature of your relationships with other people, there's a reference back to when we talked about Confucianism, which also gave rise to some unpleasantness, then that's where hysteria, mental illness, occurs among those people that stifling society is nurturing. Compassion vanishes from the whole of society and other things become more important. The miasma separates people spiritually, just in the same way that it separates people from nature. This is the real difficult thing, while masquerading as religion, while masquerading or purporting to be spiritual. And we see this as a recurring theme, no matter what extreme example of the miasma we look at. Those trials, incidentally, got more focus, because in a way they got more unfairly, they got more focus. I think at that time in general, what became the USA was actually wasn't quite as a restrictive a society as Europe had been a couple of years earlier. So I think it's unfair. But Puritanism in the contemporary weight, talking about seeing the past through the lenses of subsequent generations or previous generations, Puritanism has much less contemporary weight in the US than the Catholic Church has in Europe today. And that's why I think today we remember the Salem witch trials and not the order of magnitude more horrific European witch hunts.
Something seems to be quite... I'm seeing a theme here, and that is we're introducing concepts, myths, and stories as a social elite to control people or to allow them to self-control. So why do the people allow it so heavily to self-control themselves?
Because they've bought into this idea about belief and faith, and they think that believing and having faith and believing is seen as positive things. That's your starting point. If you want to use the miasma as social control, we talked about, you know, black shamans using lightweight miasma to control animistic peoples, you know, or to make, not necessarily control them. They didn't do anything like that. I don't believe any real shaman has ever done anything remotely on that that horrific scale, unless you believe the story about the Tunguska event, you know, the meteorite strike, which I really don't. It's first of all, changing a focus on what's important. Faith and belief, believing things, i.e. using your cerebral cortex, using the rationalization, the processing functions of your brain, and focusing on that and thinking that that's important, rather than seeing that as a supportive tool that the rest of the more important parts of the brain, like the limbic system, can make use of. That's your foundation. So first I get them believing things, and then I use those things that they believe as leverage to get them to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. Shamanism, I think, as we're going back a long way, I can't remember this episode, it's one of the earliest episodes. Shamanism and animism are absolutely not belief systems. In many ways, they are the opposite of belief systems. As a shamanistic teacher, a teacher of shamanism, or a guide, I try my level best to get my students, if you want to call them students, just people who I know, you know, who are interested in this stuff, to verify everything that I tell them or ask them to do, to verify it. And don't take my word for it. Never take my word for it. Go and test it. Go and try it. See for yourself. The only thing I ask them to take the word of is nature itself. I don't ask them to take the word of any holy book. You know, there are books that I like, books about shamanism, Food of the Gods, Eliade's Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy. There are other books, Chemical Wedding and Christian Rosenkreutz. Go and read those books. But if nature tells you something and those books tell you something else, then those books are worthless in that subject area. That's my teaching. Now, there's a very, very different attitude to if I was a teacher of, say, Christianity, you know.
Do you think in the seed of all these, just going back specifically to the witch trials, do you think the seed of where this happened was anything to do with the elites seeing what they saw as shamanism getting confused, or shamanic technique getting confused and worrying, and then it all snowballed from there? Do you think that played a role in it at all?
Well, I think the irony with the Salem witch trials is there wasn't any shamanistic technique going on. That was the real irony. These people weren't, they weren't even shamans, let alone there was a slave, effectively a slave from the Caribbean, who knew some sort of herbal medicine type of stuff, you know, and a few, you know, allegedly played a few games with the children. But that is a person who was being abused. If you look at the even contemporary descriptions of contemporary descriptions of those. Of those events, even today in modern history books, that person's role is still distorted. That was a vulnerable person being abused. There's no other way to describe it than that.
It's interesting because just relating this back to a current topic, and expressing no opinion whatsoever about it, but, you know, the whole Donald Trump and America thing. Something I noticed whilst browsing a bit of social media and stuff is Donald Trump himself has come up with a term which is quite popular and common among people nowadays, and he's just calling it, it just says fake news. So now in all his speeches and everything, he's saying, fake news, yeah, untrue news. And so then I saw these people, these comments going, when people are attacking Donald Trump for his views and stuff, or what he's done, and they're quoting what he says, you know, they're believing in what he says. He's introduced a concept. He's probably used a concept and a name and spread it among the masses.
Yeah, probably for him, there's Donald Trump exhibiting some shamanistic behavior, you know, in terms of, you know, application of the miasma. He creates a concept or an idea and then he leverages that. That's one of the techniques that shamans use in order to manipulate their societies, you know. Mm-hmm. And then people buy into it as if it's a real thing. But, you know, I, from a shamanistic point of view, you know, I'm probably far more extreme than Donald Trump. The kind of thing I'm likely to say is there any such thing as news that isn't fake?
Well, yeah, we could go down that road.
You know, that's the old, it's all fake news.
I'm not saying that there isn't fake news.
But a better way to put it is there such a thing that news that isn't based on some kind of social assumption, some kind of unspoken underlying assumption about the nature of society that perhaps isn't always true? Is there any news like that? I doubt it in this day and age.
There's that point. But, you know, you've got the rise of social media, which has resulted in all these media companies having to compete with each other for our attention and, you know, resulting in clickbait titles and all you know, high emotional impact, simplistic truths and all that kind of stuff, and it's just resulted in a whole horrendous batch of fake news and fake everything, just fake culture, where it's hard to see any kind of nuance in anything.
Yeah. Here's an advert for shamanism. Yeah, if you really get into shamanism and you do well with it and you establish, you know, You go back to your parent. You get embraced within the bosom of nature and you go back to your real parent. Yeah. Mm. You'll care about all this stuff a lot less. I'm talking about the Donald Trump stuff. You won't give a monkeys. You know, you probably won't want him to wipe out the planet or any of the other people in the world to wipe out the planet. But probably I suspect, you know, those guys really don't want to do that. So, you know, and you know, if ever one of them gets in power who does want to do that, then there's, given the society we've created, there's probably very little we can do about that. Well, what I'm saying is these things, you know, you remember I said part of the miasma is people are encouraged to have opinions and to express their opinions. And I see these stupid discussion groups, you know, the blind leading the blind, you know? And it's like, and I don't know why. I mean, some of my friends engage in those things quite heavily. I really don't know why. Because they never seem to get anywhere. You can't really resolve anything without interacting with people, without being there with them
Moving
forward.
It's all baseline. If you talk about discussion groups on the internet, it's all baseline stuff. Especially when you're talking about something physical, it's ridiculous.
Yes, and here we are, you know, my initial reluctance to do the Wolf and Angie podcast, you know.
Yeah, but at least it's a step above the whole written down text discussion groups. At least it's a interactive kind of thing.
I wouldn't take that as an assumption. What I would do is I would take that as an aspiration.
Okay, so what time are we on now, Damon? Where are we up to with this episode?
We're coming up on the hour again, mate.
Already?
We could cheat. What we could do is, you know, we said we're going to draw a line under it on this episode. I have endless examples from the business world. Yeah.
Yeah.
So why don't we say at a later date, but not too late a date, we will do a specific episode on shamanism and business.
Yeah.
And so we miss out all the many, many, many lovely and sometimes hilarious examples of the miasma in business, and we save them for that episode.
That sounds good. It also sounds helpful as well to a lot of people.
But just to wrap up, what I'd like to say, you can anything you want to wrap up, but what I'd like to say, the miasma. Think about this. The miasma infects you through culturally imposed circumstances. You can give yourself experience in which you can give yourself experience or experiences in which it's not culture but nature that is influencing you. Yeah. That is a definition of shamanic technique. The difference between doing ordinary, in inverted commas, and doing shamanic technique, in inverted commas, is in the one case, you are having experiences in which culture is influencing in you, and in the other, you're having experiences, or you're deliberately putting yourself in situations in which nature is directly influencing you without culture being interposed. And that in itself would be using the miasma as a definition of shamanic technique.
And that itself is going back to Chilicity, which is episodes 7, 8, and 9.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, guys, thank you so much for listening. Head over to the website, wovenenergy.com. And you can download a Get Started episode over there. Be sure to keep listening, and we'll see you next week. And episode, what's this episode? This is episode 15. So episode 16 next week, and I guess we're going to start kicking off for stage two, yeah?
Well, we've got an idea how to lead into the
We're
going to
start leading into it, yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Thanks so much. See you next week.
Thanks, mate.